What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, it's Pauline Marinan again here, continuing on this podcast series through which I've had the opportunity, which I hope you've enjoyed, of going through some of the topics in the chapters of this little book, What Does Law Mean, Mumu? That I drew up as an introduction to legal principles for young people. I think I also mentioned to you already that the topics covered in this book arose out of questions that had been put over a period of time, and that the book was drawn up in 2018. Interesting in that so many of the subjects raised by a group of young people of their own volition are now centre stage in the world as we see it, and have caused a great amount of attention and distress, particularly with regard to the policy in policing communities, which was a subject that recurred spontaneously, and I noted that. So in chapter 14, we discussed different courts, Latin, the language of learning, the importance of listening and language, and we make no excuse for repeating it, saying no to bullying and harassment. So we had actually just reflected on the different layers of the courts, the different thresholds in monetary terms, and the different laws or statutes that required certain cases to be referred in the first instance to a lower court, but that how with the layering and higher courts, that provided a safety net by way of an opportunity for appeals to go to a higher court in circumstances where either party would feel that justice hadn't been served in the lower courts. We also discussed how different the standards of proof were between a civil and a criminal case. And we discussed about it being on a balance of probability that one had to establish a case in a civil claim, contrasted with in a criminal case, the standard had to be beyond a reasonable doubt. We also then accidentally, as a result of an anecdote that was shared with us in the course of one of the discussions, discussed that the maxim and the principle that ignorance of the law is no defence. That came about by one of the learners recalling that a friend had seen a sign saying it is illegal to dump any material in this area, that she had commented, oh, that wouldn't stop anybody, you could come and just leave whatever you wanted there. And that led us then to discuss the origins of that and introduce the subject of Latin, because the expression comes originally from the Latin, which states that ignorantia juris non excusat, ignorance of the law excuses not. So it gave us an opportunity of discussing the principle that a person who is unaware of the law may not escape liability for violating that law merely because he was unaware of its existence. And if we looked at the thinking behind the doctrine, it's simple, really, that if a person was charged with some offence or other legal claim, they could just merely say that they were unaware and didn't realise that that existed or that they were doing something wrong to avoid liability. So, of course, defence would be very thin. And it was established then over time that there were certain obligations on people to keep themselves aware of what was right and wrong and what was allowed. Needless to say, in recent times, some interpretations have tended to weaken the concept, particularly in civil law, where the difficulty of being informed of the existence of a law, considering the lifestyle of the average citizen, has to be taken into consideration. So the evaluation of a person's knowledge of the law is widely discussed as a topic, but it's generally accepted that people should have ample warning of laws changing in a modern society, because law is widely available both in book form and on the internet, and commentary about new legislation is always heavily discussed in the media. At that point, we looked at some other Latin quotations and references, and we then just referred to the subject of Latin, which is regarded as a dead language. But in many respects, Latin has always been the language of knowledge and learning. And in summary, it could be said that as science and medicine advanced through the ages, English writers took to coining words from Greek and Latin roots. Actually, not so long ago, doctors always wrote their medical prescriptions in Latin, and there was always a presumption that people studying medicine or law had Latin as a subject. In fact, it was compulsory to have a qualification in Latin to start those courses. And then we looked at the expression bona fide, which means in good faith. It's a very commonly used expression, and it implies sincere good intention regardless of the outcome. It's relevant to not just to the study of law or to contracts, but to negotiations and for business dealings in general. For example, you could use the expression if you were discussing any of the cases that we discussed in the course of the chapters of the book, particularly the Orange Grove case, where representatives from both of the communities adjoining the resourceful Orange Grove, who had been arguing for many years about the rights of access and ownership, decided to go into a form of dispute resolution called mediation. And both sides went in with a good intention of trying to find a resolution. So they approached the process in good faith, or bona fide. It means that in human interactions, there is a sincere intention to be fair, open and honest, regardless of the outcome of the interaction. In other words, you are giving something your best shot. You're not going to prejudice the outcome, but at the same time, you're going to give the process every opportunity of being a success. Some Latin phrases, as we know, have lost their literal meaning over the centuries, but this is not the case with bona fide. It's still very widely used and interchangeable with its generally accepted modern-day English translation of in good faith. In fact, it's true to say that it's a very important concept within law and business and communications. And then there was another expression that many have heard of, and that's caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. In other words, it means that when we're purchasing something, it's up to us to make ourselves aware of all of the circumstances and have a good look before we buy, because we have to assume responsibility for having made the purchase after making many inquiries about the suitability and the quality of the product we're about to buy. Of course, if the product is not of merchantable quality, and if it doesn't provide the service or the outcome that it was intended to do so, then if it's a faulty product, the manufacturer would be liable. Then we have another commonly used expression, compos mentis, which means having command of your mind or to be of sound mind. It's also used in the negative, non compos mentis, meaning not of sound mind. I'm sure you've seen these little letters often at the end of a sentence or before a description, i.e., after something has been expressed. This is an abbreviation of id est, meaning that is, in the sense of restating something that may not have been clear in the first instance. There's another expression that is used often in relation to the children's courts and what we describe as family law courts. These cases are conducted in private, the opposite of in open court, and you'll remember how important a principle that was, but this is for the protection of the children. So it's said that such cases are held in camera, meaning literally in a chamber or in private. You probably have heard the expression in loco parentis. This is used to describe circumstances where somebody stands in the place of a parent or a guardian, for example, a teacher, or somebody conducting a school tour where the children are in their charge. It is used to refer to a person or an entity assuming the normal parental responsibility for a minor, given the circumstances. So this expression can be used in the case of schools or other institutions that act in the place of the parents on a day-to-day basis. And then we have an expression, locus standi, which means place of standing. This refers to the right of a party or a person in a legal context to appear and be heard before a court. In other words, if someone is involved in some dispute before the courts, a friend might go there to stay around outside or be on hand if they needed any support after the hearing. But they cannot stand up in the court and make any comment or contribution because they've no locus standi. They're not there as a witness, they're not there as a lawyer, so they can't make any comment. Then there's a very common expression, which is used in relation to criminal cases particularly, and that is mens rea, which means the guilty mind. It is one of the requirements for a crime to be committed, the other being actus reus, the guilty act. So for a crime to exist, there has to be the actus reus, the guilty act, and there has to be the mens rea, the guilty mind. This is essentially the basis for the notion that those without sufficient mental capacity cannot be judged guilty of a crime. But that's a very complicated area, which we didn't discuss in detail in the chapters of the book. We also mentioned that at the end of letters sometimes you will see NB written before a list of things, and that's note bene. It means note well, a term used to direct the reader to cautionary or other qualifying statements regarding the main text. And just the last one. I'm sure that you'll be tired and eager to hear the end of this Latin, but there is one interesting expression which is quite commonly used in legal court matters, and that is nulla bona, which means simply no goods. This is a notation made when a defendant, a person defending a claim against them, has no property or money available to be seized in order to comply with a judgment. So in the very sad circumstances of somebody making a claim against them, and the judge imposes that claim, and the sheriff or other officer of the court goes to seize, to strain their property or their goods to pay the amount to the person who had made the claim, they would simply report back to the court nulla bona, meaning that there were no goods existing that could be used to provide for the order of the court. So the band of learners were tipped off by that time to convey this kind of interesting discussion to Verity to see if they used Latin in the same way in France. And it would be interesting to know if reliance was placed on some of those commonly used terms in the French legal system. We then came to the subject of communications and negotiation or debate. And we talked about the fact that sometimes people really do not listen. Instead, they wait for their turn to speak, having formulated the arguments in their mind that they were going to make on a particular topic, or having banked up whatever it was they wanted to express without actually listening to what was being said by the other side. It's as if they seem to believe that the only way to convince their counterpart or those to be persuaded is to make their own case without hearing the opposing views. In negotiations, a lack of a real understanding also means that they are more vulnerable if their counterparts use difficult tactics against them. Difficult tactics may include threats, lies, false claims about lack of authority or conflicting commitments, or a host of other unpleasant behaviours intended to throw people off and curtail their bargaining power. So faced with difficult tactics, we tend to have a very constricted vision, a limited vision of our options, like giving in, retaliating, or walking away, none of which is conducive to a successful outcome or deal, which is so important to a continuing relationship, be that a personal one, a professional one, or a commercial one. So I tried in the last chapter, chapter 14, to persuade the group of learners to take away from that part of our discussion the fact that listening well, or what is referred to in some of the mediation or negotiation training courses as active listening, really empowers people who are negotiating or trying to facilitate a dispute to maintain order in the process. Unfortunately, it's the same with bullying, because people don't listen to, I suppose, the signals that others are giving to indicate how it is that they are being hurt and how they feel they're being ostracized by any kind of group or peer pressure. In talking about language in our short journey through the chapters of this book, it is true to say that language, the use of words, is central to clear and meaningful communications. A quote was referred to in chapter 14 from the American writer Mark Twain, who very wittily and poignantly made a comment about the need to use the right word. So just not being devil may care about the use of language, but of actually saying what it is you mean to say. And so in carrying on his tradition of being quite pungent, he said, "There is an importance in choosing the correct word. The difference between the almost right word and the right word is really a large matter. It's the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. Often people don't realise the importance of every word and how easily written information can be misconstrued by the reader's bias. It's the same in conversation. There are many words, as we know, over the years that have changed in time. Even when you look at the colloquial language that people use now, how often do people stop to think about the true meaning of these words, or whether the words are just a lazy way of expressing themselves without thinking and putting some effort into properly describing how they feel about something or how something appears? People use the words cool and awesome and forget that a few years ago, the words to signal that kind of response may have been groovy or fab or super. Instead, they don't. People don't actually concentrate, which is what some of the experts are saying about the loss of language through the use, overuse of social media, which of course now is almost reduced to people forgetting about words and using memes and signals and symbols instead of saying what it is they feel they want to say. Or, to controversially ask the question, do they really have anything that they want to say, or are they just following the group? Are they in groupthink and just go thumbs up because everybody else did? I leave that to you to decide and think about. Words can be addictive. So language becomes part of our integral response. Have you ever noticed how people quickly now say, you know? Count how many times a person says, you know, or like repeatedly when speaking, breaking up sentences. That's really, all of the psychologists will say, lazy speak. It's people not concentrating. And I would say, my view of it is, that people really aren't listening. So words change. And if you think I'm exaggerating about how words influence us, I would suggest that sometimes the whole meaning of a word changes or something. Sometimes a trendy word simply goes out of style. Some words lose their appeal over time, and unfortunately we become addicted to words that we use without even thinking what their true meaning is. Somebody mentioned an exercise which I conveyed to the group of learners in Chapter 14 about this group of young people who were shown a video reenactment of a collision between two cars. In the course of that video, the red car collided with a black car. The video played for about 3 minutes, and the group went away and were told to come back in a week's time. Then they were divided into two groups. One of the groups was asked what they recalled from the video when the black car collided with the red car, and they described what they recalled seeing. The other group was asked what they saw when the red car smashed into the black car. That group described in some detail how they recalled the accident and the windows being shattered in the crash, which hadn't actually happened in the video. But the use of the word smashed somehow brought to the listeners' minds the notion of the shattering of a windscreen and glass. So I had said all of this in the discussion to remind the group of the importance of listening skills and the importance of clarity in the words we use in our communications. We need to be precise. We need to be precise in everyday exchanges, not to mention in the legal system or in the law, or if we're working in that area, but even in our everyday engagements in business, in our professional lives, and I would suggest in our private lives. I'd also recommend a very good exercise, which is taking a topic for debate, dividing a group of people into threes, and sending them off into different corners, with one person being the observer and the other two pitching each side of the debate, some topic that's up currently. And so give them 10 minutes for A and B to have a discussion, and the C person, number three in the group, would be there as an observer and take notes of what they were saying. And then come back to the general session and give a report back of how the discussion and the debate went and who said what. I'd recommend that to you. It's quite revealing. It's revealing for all involved in the exercise. So as the chapters grew to the end and we reflected on the world as it is now, Mumu described her own sense of despair in a way at the world that her generation was handing on. And having had all the excitement of the era of her growing up and her university and early life days, she believed that that generation was really going to fix things and come up with lots of solutions. All that she could say to the group of learners in whom she had expressed her great pride and praise for the way they had tenaciously stayed with this project over a period of time, and the fact that they had stuck with very difficult topics that may at times have been quite complex, but their curiosity and their interest had never waned. All that they could be left with was that there were structures there. We did have the European Union. We did have the United Nations. We have the Security Council. We have lots of groups that are there to keep dialogue open so that we can cooperate in relation to matters of common interest. There are good legal systems and processes to enable people to have access to justice and to protect their rights. Nevertheless, all of those processes are central, and it was a firm belief expressed in Chapter 14 and expressed now that really process, when they're defined and when they work, should be sacrosanct. They should be there to be revered and respected. And a caveat goes out to never let people tinker with the processes. Good process has to be followed even in the smallest examples. If it is in a mediation process, if it is the way meetings are conducted, if it's the organising of elections, if it's the treatment of people's complaints at work or elsewhere, human resource practices in an organisation, the handling of allegations of bullying and harassment, whatever is involved in the treatment of people and their rights should aim to have the high standards as they are applied in our courts. As regards corruption and interference with those good processes, well, that's another day's work. We quoted Seamus Heaney quite a lot in the book, and we referred to his particular comment, which was relevant to this voyage of discovery, this walk and talk with a group of young people who are interested in delving into the legal practices and processes and administrative systems underpinning a democratic society, when he said, every generation is on its own conveyor belt. And the young learners became very aware that they are now going to be the next conveyor belt. And in the course of that, we referred to the need for reconciliation, where parties have, or communities have been divided by something, and then the process of reconciliation is bringing them back together again. And then we face the awful truth that sometimes that's never going to happen, because two sides of a community, two sides of an ethnic divide, whatever it is, the sectarian divide that are breaking people apart, will never be any different, because people just don't like the other side and they don't tolerate them. They don't approve of them and they feel alienated by them. And we said that then we have to have the process of reconciling, a process of ecumenics, of saying, well, there are differences, but we recognize the differences. So that process of reconciling two sides is a valuable process and needs to be studied and understood in order to be properly practiced. So ecumenism, the process of ecumenics, which is recognizing and respecting the differences. And really, it's only through that kind of exercise that there can be a manageable harmony or a tolerable management of relations between communities. Seamus Heaney also was heard to say, when he was talking about the great conflicts raging in Northern Ireland, a part of Ireland that had for many years gone through very violent and difficult times of sectarian division and political division. And in that context, he had once said in the course of one of his works, the voice of reason has grown hoarse. And it beautifully put, that moment of exasperation when all the good people and all the reasonable people had done what they could and felt that there was never, ever going to be any moment when hands would come across the table and shake and say, OK, we will respect and regard the differences, and we will try to design and devise a way of accommodating those differences. We will look, as indeed in the principle of the mediation that we discussed in the course of the book, we will look not to our rights and have a rights-based approach and say, I've got a right to that and you don't have a right to that, or my rights are superior to yours. But what we will look at is our joint interests, and we will look for that zone of potential agreement and recognition of where our interests overlap. So it's in our interest to have a society that works, to have a good justice society, and to have a good legal system, and to have a good political system with fair and equal representation, and to have fair and open elections, and all that goes with that. It was noteworthy that in chapter 14, when the learners were asked what they had put to Verity in their first submission to her and exchange of information in the Penfriend project, that they had asked about the symbols of justice, about the courts, about how people dressed and appeared, and what the overall standards were and the appearance of the formality of that world. But also they asked how the people felt about the judges, about the system, and interestingly, how they felt about their police and the police force. And so in many respects, as we said, I think, in the opening chapters when we were explaining to Verity that in the Irish Republic, the translation of the Garda Síochána means the guardian of the peace. And so police, that's what they are. Police forces are the guardians of the peace. That's not the military. That's not the army. That's not the defence or the armed forces. They have a different role. That's defending the country against attack. And they have no role or part in the everyday management of crime within the communities. And so it's very important to read a lot about that and investigate that as to why that is the case. And also to bear in mind that at the end of the day, people have, what was it? Nova, I think it was, in the course of the book, said when we were talking about war and discussing the wonderful anti-war hero Harry Patch, who devoted the remainder of his long life after reaching 100 to trying to propagate the word, as he said, that war was just legitimized murder. But I think it was Nova who came out with the words, "Why can't we share this world together? We only have one world." And those were extremely poignant words, and really a very good way, I think, of ending the book, because the book began with questions. The reason for the book was as a result of curiousness and questions. And we'll end the book on a question, because it was put by one of the learners, who is, as Seamus Heaney said, going to be on the next generational conveyor belt. Thank you.